where am I? I'm on the history. So here's the three-dimensional result, and then I have to mention three more names. The last one is us. So there was a fellow named T.Y. Sun, who published in 1981, this is 1986, and then we published our first paper on this in 2000, so I just have to make sure the priority is clear, of course, because there's a paper by Groves and Mielke. In certain rectangular cases with finite depth in 2001. But what's astonishing, this is just about all I know. This is all the results I know about three and higher dimensional traveling waves. And traveling waves are supposed to be the simple case. And all of these have sigma greater than zero, and I think one of the duties I have is to explain why sigma equals zero is an interesting and open problem. And again, I say small. It's a problem which even an elliptic problem, with a nonlinear elliptic, it has small divisors, like a dynamical system. So, I really am feeling time pressure, but it plays. I have to start here. I have to say these things. So this is my section two. That was all my section one. I want to talk about Zaharov's Hamiltonian. Because it is important in this problem that the problem be a Hamiltonian problem. So there's an energy. So all this stuff actually can be posed as Hamiltonian system. So there's energy. I'll call it H because it's going to be the Hamiltonian. It's integral over my fundamental domain. So that's over the torus Tn minus 1, which is the horizontal variables mod the lattice, and then also integral from minus h up to the surface, eta, times 1/2 grad phi squared dy dx. That clearly is half u squared sum, so it's the kinetic, has the right form of the kinetic energy, and it's the Dirichlet integral for the fluid domain. And there's a potential energy too, which is integral over Tn minus 1, g upon 2, eta squared, eta is the height, and in the presence of surface tension, there's also a term which is sigma root 1 plus dx eta squared. Oh, it's the surface area, or normalized surface area. I'm going to take away 1, so finite perturbations in the non-compact domain would also still have this finite dx. While I'm at it, that's the energy. While I'm at it, there's also a momentum. Yes? This is Euler's flow. Euler flow. Still the curvature. Because that's the area, and the variation of the area is going to give me the mean curvature. There's a momentum, which, there's vertical momentum that I don't want to talk about. There's a horizontal momenta. And since I'm in higher horizontal dimensions, 2 or maybe 10, this is a vector. So the jth momentum is equal to the double integral from minus h up to eta and over the horizontal extent of the x jth derivative of phi dy dx, which is, again, the jth velocity times the mass, which is density is normalized to 1, sum over the continuous mechanical system. But I can integrate by parts to find this is actually the integral over the torus. If I integrate by parts and get the right sign, it's minus phi dx j eta dx, integral over the surface. And that's just a number, the energy, and n minus 1 number is the horizontal velocity, horizontal momenta. The subtlety of Zaharov in his ill-understood 1968 paper was, what are the variables with respect to which this is a Hamiltonian system? And so I'm going to say that the variables are z are equal to eta of x is one of them, and maybe that's even you can guess, but also xi of x. I haven't said what xi is yet. Where? These are where xi of x is, which is the boundary values of the velocity potential. And just to make that clear, it's not phi. If I take variations with respect to xi, phi is a function of xi. And it has, that's just important to keep clear. Good. It doesn't deny the fact that this is ill understood and people debated it for a couple of decades. And the new paper is clearer. Okay. But I think our paper is also pretty clear. I mean, but of course I'm me, so everyone can complain about, anybody else can complain about that. Well, so a Hamiltonian system to me is something of the following form. Z dot is equal to J gradient of H. And so I want to say with respect to these variables, all those Euler equations which are in yellow and 1 over here can be rewritten as equation 2, d by dt of the vector eta and xi is equal to j, so it's going to be 0, the identity, minus the identity 0, the gradient of h with respect to eta, and the gradient of eta of h with respect to xi. And then this equations 1, if you write it that way, have the form which is required. And now the only puzzle is, how does H, and for that matter, how does I, depend on eta, and how does it depend on xi? Well, they depend on those, but not so explicitly. So it behooves us to rewrite. So rewrite using the Dirichlet-Neumann operator. And I'm going to do that as follows. Let me say the following, that when I define phi, it's of course a function of x and y. So phi is a potential function, it's a function of x and y. But before you even start to think about it, you should fix the domain. So it's a functional of eta, which serves to define the domain. And then after you have the domain, it's a functional of your boundary data. So it's also a functional of xi. Okay, but after you factor those complicated and implicit dependencies in, now it's a function of x and y, and it will change in time. Okay, so what I want to do is rewrite h to make the dependence on eta and xi more explicit. And I'm going to do that by rewriting the Dirichlet integral in terms of the Dirichlet-Neumann operator, which goes as follows. Integral over that torus, so over surface variables, 1 half xi g eta xi dx. And you recognize that as if you integrated by parts, there would be a boundary term, which was phi grad phi dot n ds, which is exactly this quadratic form in the boundary data, where G is some operator. That's the kinetic energy. The potential energy is quite a bit easier. I'm just going to say it's G upon 2. It depends pretty clearly on eta. It doesn't depend on phi, so I'll just repeat myself. G upon 2 eta squared dx, and I'll just say sigma times the area. And that's what I want to use. And now, the interesting thing is that you take this. It's a little bit easier to differentiate with respect to xi, because this is a quadratic form in xi, and tells us that the eta dot is the xi derivative of h. And also, you take this equation, it tells us that xi dot is equal to minus the eta derivative of h. And so this we can differentiate, it's just a linear function of eta. This we can also differentiate, that's what gives us the mean curvature. And this is an interesting derivative. It says you take the Dirichlet integral, and for fixed boundary data in these coordinates, you vary the domain. And it's related to the variational formula of Adamal. Anyway, you use that, and you plug it in this equation, and those are the water wave problems. I've introduced time dependence, but it's a general statement, but I'd rather go back to the frame of reference traveling wave problem again. And now I'm also reminded that I didn't say something, which is I'll say I'm in section 3 back to traveling waves. And so let's examine the following. If eta of xt has to be of the form of eta of x minus tc, then a t derivative of eta is really a minus c dot dx derivative of eta by the chain rule. And similarly, I'm going to be in a situation where I have c of xt is equal to c of x minus tc. And so a derivative with respect to c is equal to minus c dot dx of c. And what I want to say is that this also can be seen as a Hamiltonian system with respect to the momentum. That is, it's d by dt of the pair eta c equals c dot, let me do it this way, j, where this matrix is j, the variation, j, the variation with respect to eta of I, the variation with respect to xi of I. I'm in trouble because I is a vector, so this is now a vector, and it's c vector dot that. If there were only one direction, I would be a scalar, but it's a several horizontal directions. Okay? And now I want to make a count. Before anything else, I just want to count. I want to say c is an r n minus 1 dimensional parameter. And so when n is 2, then this is a one-dimensional parameter, and all these lists of people have found bifurcation curves. So you find curves where the speed is part of the solution, and you solve for it, and you parameterize the speed and the you parameterize by finding a relationship between the speed of a solution and the amplitude of a solution. But when n is bigger, for example, when n is equal to, so one, if n equals 1 is bifurcation curves. That's what I was just saying. When n is higher, such as when n is equal to, sorry, when n is equal to 2, n minus 1 is 1. When n is equal to 3, of course, the place of most interest, then these actually, there are two parameters, and you don't find curves, you actually find surfaces, so bifurcation surfaces. And for general n, you will find n minus 1 dimensional varieties of solutions. That's just an interesting fact. Now, if I take equation 2, I plug in this little calculation, and I want to solve an equation, I'm going to get, let me call this 2. So this is our equation 3. Let me just plug it in and then do all the derivatives. And then you get an interesting equation, which we now have to solve. One is c dot partial x eta is equal to, plus the Dirichlet-Neumann operator on c equals 0. That's the first component, which you can recognize by reading this across. And then the second component is c dot partial x c minus g eta minus 1 half 1 plus dx eta squared times parenthesis, big parenthesis, dx c squared minus g eta c quantity squared minus twice dx eta dot dx c times g eta c plus dx c squared dx eta squared minus twice dx eta dot dx c squared plus close parentheses, plus sigma times dx, dx eta, 1 plus dx eta squared, of surface tension term, equals 0. So, a lot of terms, and highly nonlinear in derivatives. G is an order 1 operator. However, conceptually, it's very simple. Conceptually, this is conceptually simple. So it goes as follows. This reads, remember, d by dt a to c is c dot j, the variation of I. And then the right-hand side is j, the variation of h. So I can write 3, that is 1, 2, 1, which is 2, which is now 3. I can write it as 4, which is the variation of h minus c dot the variation of I equals 0. Point. And now I just want to say what that is. Well, it's clearly going to be a Lagrange multiplier rule for something. And let me try to articulate what that is. So I'm going to look at mappings. S, which take a torus. Oh, I'm going to, an n minus 1 torus, I guess. It's two torus, I was thinking in three dimensions, an n minus 1 torus. And it puts, and it's a mapping into some phase space. And my phase space is going to be, say, HR minus 1 Sobolev spaces cross HR. So these are going to be the etas, and these are going to be the c's. Other way around. R, no, R minus 1 R, that's right. Etas, and those are going to be the c's. And among this class of mappings, so for every torus, you have a set of periodic functions, and these are parameterized over R n minus 1 mod this gamma, right? And I have a group act plus a group action. R is some Sobolev index, so these are Sobolev spaces. And R has to be greater than or equal to some minimum R naught, which I think has to be n plus 1 over 2. Maybe it has to be greater than that for the Sobolev embedding theorem. And otherwise, it's arbitrary. So fix it to be the minimum you want, you need. And it's just fixed. And then use last week's lecture to take any R up to, as long as it's big enough, up to real analytic. The group action is as follows, that I want, let's see, T of alpha, I want alpha to be in the torus also, and it takes x to x plus alpha. And its reflection on solutions is I want to eta x, cx to be taken to eta of x plus alpha, c of x plus alpha. And under this group action, h is invariant, and I is invariant. And I want to look at these maps, which are equivariant with respect to this group action. So mappings, group action, equivariant mappings. And if you do so, let me see, I need to give the, let me just call this some big X. It's like my phase space. It's a definition of my phase space. If I call those the equivariant mappings, then I do the following thing. I'm going to look at a subset of that. So MA is subset of X defined by, so this is the definition of MA, is equal to all those possible mappings such that when I calculate the momentum of that mapping, each mapping has a momentum. It's this double integral, right? It's integral. So if I look at the I1 momentum, it's a fixed number A1. If I look at the IN minus 1th momentum, it's equal to some number AN minus 1 and all the ones in the middle, too. That's a subset of mappings. Unbounded, momentum isn't such a good thing, but it's a but it's a subset of such mappings. And then this MI, then I just want to remark that the equation 5 is the Lagrange multiplier rule. For critical points of H on M A. Equation four. And if we can find such, then they sit in our solar space, and we've solved their problem. And furthermore, topology of MA influences the number of critical points. Now I have an analogy, but I feel even with the alarm, we shouldn't go too long because we have another talk. So I'm going to try to talk for 3 more minutes, and I'm just going to mention the analogy. So this is very similar setting to Alan Weinstein's version of the resonant Lyapunov center theorem. And in fact, that's the start of the theory, and Jürgen Moser gave a general version of this and a analytic proof using a Lyapunov-Schmidt decomposition, and that's exactly what the proof does here. So I now have to decide what precisely I want to do in the next 5 minutes or less. And so I'm going to actually put this up to vote. This is always good to vote. I could either talk about the topology, which gives you a counting argument for give you a counting argument for a number of multiplicity of solutions. Well, first of all, after that, I'm going to state a theorem. And then I could either explain why the multiplicity is present in that theorem, or I could come back and talk about the linear theory, so where are the bifurcation points, and why, when sigma is zero, is it a small divisor problem. I could either talk about one or the other. So let's call A, we have to vote for A or B. A is the equivariant cohomology, and B is the linear theory. So who votes for A? Who votes? I find 3 people because I voted for A. Who votes for B? I also vote for B. That seems we have 6 people. Okay, so 6-3, the 6 wins. Seems to me there's a lot of non-voting population here. Okay, so I'd like to state a theorem. Maybe I should leave these on the board and I'll state a theorem. So I first count multiplicity. So the equations are, so this is now going to be equation 5. My equations are the variation of H minus C dot the variation of I equals 0. But what I want to do is linearize about 0 and study the linear solutions. So I take the second variation of H at 0, applied to some linear deformation of a mapping, minus C dot the second variation of I about 0 applied to S. And I want to study this problem. Are there any homogeneous solutions? And I have to study it in this class, that is, those mappings. Really, you can just describe them using the Fourier transform. I'll show you. But you study it in that class of mappings near zero. And let's say, and it turns out that so let's say, if sigma is greater than zero, there's a finite, the number of solutions is finite dimensional. Sigma equals zero, maybe not. I'll show you that. And it has to be even, so it's going to be 2m dimensional. The dimension is 2m. And so M is the number of resonances. So now I can state the theorem. So this is theorem 2, which is the real theorem, which is suppose, let's see, sigma, so our dimension n is greater than, I'll just make n equal 3 if you don't mind. N equals 3, then it's easier for me to count. So that's the dimension. And let me say it this way, and the multiplicity, well, it depends on C, and you can choose C, so this is 0. That's not a bifurcation point. You can choose C, so M is 1, so this is 2. You can do better, because as I said, you find bifurcation surfaces. So the minimum M that's interesting is 2, so this is 4. And the multiplicity, I want to say, M is greater than or equal to 2. So this is 4 or higher. Then nearby, now let me say it this way. Then nearby, I want to say that then for all choices of momenta, A is an n minus 1 vector, so I'll just say that sufficiently small, there exists at least m minus 1 distinct periodic solutions. So it is a doubly periodic traveling wave solutions. With momentum A. So one way to say that is on that submanifold MA. And this is wrong as stated, because for all choices of A such that MA non-singular. And there's a way of choosing MA non-singular, but occasionally it's degenerate, and then we haven't done a finer analysis. But most of the time, most choices of momentum A, it's non-singular, and then you have M minus 1 geometrically distinct solutions. And each time you have a solution, there's a group action. So actually, and the group action really just consists in moving the origin. So every time you have a solution, you have a two torus of solutions. It's like in dynamical systems, every time you have a periodic orbit, you have a circle of periodic orbits just from changing where you considered that you were starting. So I'd like to explain why there can be multiplicity and why, when sigma is equal to 0, it's a small divisor problem. And when I do that, I also want to explain, you know, because the time is getting late, and because we did have, I don't know, a certain amount of alarm time, I think we should, after tea, we don't have to rush back to Misha Vishek's talk. If Misha is agreeable, we could start a little bit late. Is that agreeable? I'm just feeling like I want to finish with one blackboard, but then I feel I'm rushing it. So let me just do that, though. So again, let's think of n equals 2, and I want to linearize, and I want to study this equation. So in fact, this equation is the following form, doing the Fourier transform. It's the diagonal. It's a 2x2 diagonal matrix on periodic functions on a torus consisting of G. I better look at my notes because I am getting a field. G plus sigma K squared K O. If X lives in Rn minus 1 mod a lattice, then its Fourier transform of the Fourier transform of functions periodic over this live in the dual lattice. So this is going to be K in the dual lattice. And just to linearize and tell you what that looks like, this is the diagonal, and k hyperbolic tangent h k. And I'm sorry for people who did not come to the seminar that day where I described the hyperbolic tangent. It's part of the dispersion relation. I c dot k, and it has to be Hermitian symmetric, so minus I c dot k. K is a vector because dual lattice is in R n minus 1 as well. And it's interesting to understand when that has zero determinant. Because if this has zero determinant, that says there's a Fourier mode which satisfies this equation. So what I'm going to do is, for the moment, forget that K is in a dual lattice in Rn minus 1 and just draw the zero set of that in Rn minus 1. And then I'm going to put in a lattice and see whether it touches or not. Okay? And every time we touch, we'll get an element of the null space. So I need a little bit of room. So here's K space, and I'm taking K in R2, so that's the dimension is equal to 3. So this is K1, and this is K2, and let me put in, and this the whole thing depends on C, so I'm going to put in a sample C, and then I'm going to draw the picture, and then C can of course be switched around. So here's C. That's a trial phase velocity. And then I have to say, when the determinant of this vanishes, that's when I get an eigen value. So the determinant, of course, is going to be g plus sigma k squared times k tanh h k. Now, the funny thing is, minus, 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 it gives minus c dot k squared. And I want to know, this is the determinant. It depends on c. And I want to know, when is this equal to 0? So there's c. Let me draw the zero set of this. Well, a typical picture for the zero set would be something like this. And then negative it. And where that zero set, so you can imagine adjusting C, so you get a point in the null space. So you adjust C a little bit until you find a K1, one vector in the null space. And that says, M is now 1. And of course you have minus it. And then you can imagine there's still a little bit of room left in C, where that leaves that K1 fixed, and you're allowed to touch another one. So now you can hit a K2. And of course, negative it is also in it. So this is now M is equal to 2 situation where the null space is 4-dimensional. But it could be that in doing so, you hit other points in the lattice. Since it's a transcendental operation, you don't really have a heck of a lot of control on things. So it could be there's a K3 out here, which you accidentally hit, so to speak, and it's pair. And that's a case of M equals 3. And in doing this linear analysis, we find we have a lemma, which is that sigma positive implies M is finite. And I'm just going to finish by taking another color, maybe I'll take blue, and show what happens, what is the effect on this curve when sigma is infinite? Well, this distance from the origin is basically 1 upon sigma, 1 upon root sigma. And so when I take sigma to 0, this becomes infinite. And in matter of fact, this curve is asymptotic to something which looks like a square root around the orthogonal axis to C, and it's unbounded. So this curve looks like this, and goes, it has a kind of a curious shape, but it goes like that. And then that's negative. And it's exactly in these directions that you can be hit possibly infinitely many points. It's because it's an infinite, it's a non-compact curve. But maybe worse, the small divisors is you are guaranteed to get close. And not only that, but to get this determinant close, that is the eigenvalue, in fact, close to infinitely often to points in the lattice. And if you were to invert this equation, you have to invert this matrix, so you have to divide by this determinant, essentially. And that can do you damage when you're close to a zero. That's the small divisor problem. I'll stop with this point, which is there at least should be a physical expression for that small divisor problem, because it's a physical problem. And that comes from, and why is it different from 2 and 3? And that comes from the fact that you can have small high frequency oscillations which have arbitrarily long period when you're in 3 or higher wave propagation problems such as this. Let me say that again. If you're moving in the frame of reference of a wave at speed C naught, which is close to root GH, say speed C naught, then any oscillation which is in this direction with you is basically left behind as you travel, because very slight, small oscillations for the water wave problem move very slowly. But if you have 3 or higher dimensions, remember you're a torus, so you're periodic. If you have 3 or higher dimensions, a small perturbation of high frequency which tries to travel obliquely to your C will stay with you for a long time and take a long time to travel to cross the torus and reoccur. Well, eigenvalues are 1 over periods, and small divisors are 1 over eigenvalues. So a long period is a small frequency, it's a small divisor. So that's a physical argument which gives rise to that picture in the K-plane of the small denominators. I'm sorry I took so long, and sorry that the fire interrupted us.